many of you, it's first time to New Orleans here? A bunch of you. Okay. Well, it's a fabulous town, but just if you are out and about, especially in the French Quarter, and some guy comes up to you and says, you know, I bet you 50 bucks I know where your shoes came from. And just say, or I know where you got your shoes. Make sure you say, on my feet, because that's the correct answer. If not, they're going to try to steal a bunch of money from you. So just be on the lookout for that. And that's true. So if you're in the French Quarter, and someone comes up to you and says, I bet you 50 bucks I know where you've got your shoes. And you think, oh, there's no way he knows where I got my shoes from. But the answer is they're on your feet. You got them on your feet. So, and then he's going to want 50 bucks, and if not, he's going to get all upset. So just a little experience I've had here before, so that I'd share that. And I'm not the only one that's had that experience. So just today, I'm going to just give you a sky-high overview of some of the things that can be gleaned from DNA test development and deployment in the tree fruit crops that I've had experience working with to help enable marker-assisted breeding in black raspberry. And no, I'm not going to do any transgenics of putting DNA in black raspberry, as Terrence pointed out earlier. So, and then I've just got to, I know this is black raspberry, and I really appreciate all of you being here and the support that you've given to us grad students, and just the invitation to talk to you. But I got to give a lot of credit to the Rosebreed Project. I'm sure most of you are familiar with, because that's the reason I'm here today, their support over the past 5 years. And a lot of what's been done in tree fruit is thanks to a lot of the efforts of the researchers involved in that project. So, I'm Paul Sandifer. I did my Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Science at the University of Arkansas, working with Dr. John Clark. And so I'm probably sure most of you are familiar with him, and I'm just trying to integrate his spirit here to make this presentation exciting. And so my projects were all field-based and mainly traditional plant breeding type projects. So I got a really good introduction to what fruit breeding is all about. 2.5 years ago, I moved to Washington State University, started working for Dr. Cameron Peace, where all my work has been laboratory and computer-based on developing DNA tests and enabling their deployment in several breeding programs. And so these are my breeding programs, I like to say. So that's John Clark there holding one of his low-acid white peaches. He breeds peaches, blackberries, grapes, some other crops there at University of Arkansas. Dr. Kate Evans, Washington State University apple breeder, and Ndozi Oruguzi, the Pacific Northwest sweet cherry breeder. And so for all of you grad students who are thinking about taking on or are currently doing QTL studies or DNA test deployment, this is what you really need if you don't want your publication to just be on the shelf in the library. If you want it to act, what you're going to do, get applied in breeding, you need breeders who are willing to help you and who are excited about this new technology. And there's a lot of those in this room here today. So I did a search a month or so ago on the National Center for Biotechnology Information website. I just did Rubus and I did Prunus. And I put this up here not to make those of you working with Rubus jealous, but it probably does a little bit. But I put, and that was my point, is that it's coming your way. And so you're going to have a plethora of amazing sequence information on genes, all sorts of things that are tools that you're going to be able to use. And so that leads to what I'm going to talk about for the next, hopefully, 45 minutes or so. And because this is a pretty diverse audience, I thought I'd just give a primer on marker-assisted breeding, what it is, and why I think it's going to be a thing that everyone is going to want to adopt. And then just some general considerations before you go QTL hunting. And then a little bit on DNA test development, DNA test deployment, and then just wrap up a little bit. So marker-assisted breeding, tomorrow's traditional breeding. In some crops, it's today's traditional breeding, in my opinion. So I'm not going to go into details here because most of you probably already know this, but traditional breeding is based on the phenotype, based on physical observations, where you select individuals because you think they'll make great parents, you cross them, and then you grow out the offspring. And in most breeding programs, you're trying to maximize the number of offspring that go from a seed to a tree in the field, or in this case, a bush in the field, you can evaluate. And sometimes, this is from the Washington State University apple breeding program, that can be 14 to 18 years from a cross to where you evaluated enough to think it has cultivar potential. And then some breeding programs do field and or greenhouse inoculations, and so they reduce their numbers of seedlings that are field planted. But for the most part, you're just trying to maximize that number that you can actually do some phenotyping on. So all of this is done under the umbrella of limited resources with decreasing federal funding, state funding for breeding programs since the 1960s, and then increased competition. Your pocketbook is getting smaller. And so breeding's expensive, it's resource intensive, it's a long-term process. And then one thing I've heard from a lot of breeders is that, you know, they rely a little bit on serendipity. And so I ask, you know, your best cultivar, how did it happen? And several of them say, well, it was just chance. It just happened. I just found it out in the field. I think a lot of that is them being humble, which, you know, is a good thing. But at the same time, I don't think relying on chance in this competitive world is necessarily the most sustainable process ahead. So how can we make fruit breeding more sustainable? One way is by utilizing DNA information. So just a quick look through some literature you can find where they say it'll increase genetic gain per breeding cycle, increase your selection efficiency, reduce your overall operating costs, and could potentially even accelerate the development of novel cultivars. And so, but then you got to ask why, or how, shall I say. And one of the major ways is through marker-assisted breeding, and that is the use of not necessarily just molecular markers that Michael explained what those are earlier, but what a marker that's associated with a specific genomic region that is importantly associated with a specific trait and variations at that marker that are associated with specific trait levels. And that's the key. And within marker-assisted breeding, you have parent selection, and that's where you're using what I like to call DNA tests, which are those marker locus trait associations, to help choose which will be the best parent to use. What will be the best cross combination so that you have the highest proportion of offspring that meet the trait thresholds that you've set. Then there's also marker-assisted seedling selection, where you screen your seedlings with these DNA tests and you field plant only those that are predicted to have the trait levels that you're looking for. You can also use DNA tests in several other aspects of the program, such as in your replicated trials, many other ways. Apart from direct marker-assisted breeding, you can use DNA information to simply better understand trait genetics, calculate relatedness, determine parentage. As Michael mentioned earlier, a lot of times, Jewel, you know, for example, it's thought that, you know, we know the parents, we've known it for a long time, but in fact, you were wrong. You can also use it to assign unique identity, which can help for intellectual property rights. And so each application has different requirements. And one of the biggest requirements is the fact that a molecular marker is not a DNA test. And so a lot of times molecular marker is used to refer to a DNA test, but it is simply just a variation at the DNA level that you can pick up routinely. Whereas a DNA test, on the other hand, is a molecular marker with that association with a trait. And I know I'll beating a dead horse here, but it's a really important point to make. So calculating relatedness, determining parentage, assigning and determining unique identity, you just need molecular markers. Whereas for parent selection and seedling selection, you need DNA tests. And then all of this relies on a relationship between genomicists, those that are out seeking the underlying genetic control of a trait, so those QTL hunters out there, the geneticists who then work to convert that genomics knowledge into predictive genetic tests, or in other words, DNA tests, and then breeders who theoretically use those genetic tests to support breeding decisions. Then the question arises, does this really happen? And a lot of the agronomic crops today, this does. This is definitely happening. And then in some of the tree fruits, thanks to projects such as Roseweed, this is happening. But in a lot of crops, it's really not happening yet at the level that I'd like to see, a lot of us would like to see. And a big reason for that is that there's just no good DNA tests for the traits that are important to breeders. And so with that, just like to go into some basic considerations, and there's a ton, Jill mentioned a whole bunch of them earlier, of what, before you go and go QTL hunting, some things you should do before you pull the trigger and make sure that you're hunting the right animal there. So, consideration number one, make sure the trait you're interested in is breeding relevant. And that's not just relevant to you as a researcher, that's relevant to consumers, distributors, packaged market processed producers, and then therefore breeders. And Michael mentioned aphid resistance earlier. And so talking to breeders such as Michael to get an idea of what traits are important, Just two quick examples from recent Good Fruit Grower magazines is how many of you have heard of the Arctic apple? Right? Most of you. And so that's an apple that was genetically modified. It's a Granny Smith and a Golden Delicious, I believe, that were genetically modified so they don't brown when they're cut. And when you think about it, that's pretty cool. But at the same time, when you go and ask the industry and you ask the breeders, is that trait really important? They say, well, we actually already have it in existing apple germplasm. The latest Washington State University apple release, you can leave for 9 hours on your counter and it doesn't brown. Then another thing the industry says is, well, actually most of the apples that go into the cut market are cull anyway. They're not pretty enough to make it onto your fruit shelf. And so there's not a high value placed on that trait in breeding. So maybe not a trait that's worth the millions of dollars that was required to develop this apple. Another good fruit grower example is this was a recent article about the Pacific Northwest Sweet Cherry Breeding Program. And the second paragraph there, I don't know if you can read it, but it says, we want 30% early red. We want 10% early blush. We want 30% late red, etc., etc. So when you read this, one of the traits that definitely pops out as being really important to the industry would be maturity date. So obviously, they're really interested in that. And if you're a breeder paying attention to your industry, in this case, the one that funds most of the breeding activities, you would target that trait. Consideration number two, and this is true in just about every aspect of research that I'm sure you all are doing, and that's the accurate and targeted phenotyping is essential. So you don't have to go out and publish a protocol like Kate Evans did here on large-scale standardized phenotyping an apple. But it is really important, especially in these collaborative projects, that everyone's on the same page in evaluating the trait. And then two other big musts is that one, uniform maturity evaluation. And this is really important for most of your fruit quality traits because they're all correlated with the degree of ripeness, you could say, when the fruit is harvested. And in a lot of crops, this is the major challenge. Julia Harshman, one big aspect of her project is trying to figure out how we can better evaluate maturity in apple. And hopefully she's finding some good results because it's a major challenge, especially in these segregating populations. It's not just a standard field of all one variety. And then the next big must is appropriately dissecting your trait. And I have two examples here, peach versus nectarine. It's the first one where we set out, we evaluated the degree of pubescence on peaches. And we measured it on a scale 1 to 5, 1 being absolutely no pubescence and a 5 being way fuzzier than you ever want to put in your mouth. And when we ran that through our QTL analysis, and we had 4 locations in 3 years, really great data. When we ran it through, we didn't find anything. And this is a major surprise because we already knew that it's a major trait. They already know the gene. You know, how come we didn't find it? It's segregating in our population. But it was because we used a quantitative scale when it's really just a qualitative trait. We converted the data into 0 and 1 binary data with anything that didn't have pubescence, we gave a 0. Anything with pubescence, we gave a 1. And lo and behold, we found the major trait loci we were looking for. Opposite example is apple sweetness. Yingzhu Guan, a PhD student at the University of Washington, studied apple sweetness, sensory, and soluble solids content. And a bunch of data on cross years and wide germplasm, and she didn't find much, nothing significant. But then when she took a closer look at sweetness and did some gas chromatography, I believe, and looked at the individual sugars, evaluated that on the same germplasm, lo and behold, she found a very significant QTL for fructose content. So that gave us a really good thing to target as far as DNA test development. Consideration number three, is your germplasm breeding relevant? And this has already been emphasized in the presentations today, such as Michael was mentioning about needing to think outside the standard germplasm to get those alleles you really need. And so here's just an example from a publication in Apricot where a group of researchers had developed a DNA test for plumpox virus resistance. And then a later date set out to validate that and confirm that this test actually works in breeding-relevant germplasm. And lo and behold, they found that it doesn't. It doesn't work in their germplasm. And so maybe if they discovered this previously and validated that QTL in their germplasm beforehand, they would have saved some money in targeting that, but it did make a really great publication. So finally, consideration number four is how useful would a DNA test targeting your genomic region of interest actually be? And by this, I'm mainly meaning the relationship between the heritability of the trait and the amount of phenotypic variance that is explained by your single genomic region. And heritability, just simply broad sense heritability, and then how much of the phenotypic variance is explained. The relationship's really important. I tried to have three examples here, and I thought of a long analogy, but it took me about 12 minutes just to explain it to myself. So I'm going to skip that one. But if you have a trait that's highly heritable, and then you have your genomic region that's only explaining just a tiny little bit of that puzzle, then more than likely you're going to be able to make significant progress just through traditional breeding practices for the trait, and it might not be worthwhile targeting that specific locus with a DNA test alone. Maybe if you targeted four or five of those, combined them, you'd explain more of that phenotypic variance. But alone, it might not be worth the cost and resources. On the other hand, if you have a trait that's not very heritable, but then you find that single genomic region that really is explaining most of the phenotypic variance for the trait that of the component that's heritable, now that's going to be a really good target. And then third example are some traits where it's highly heritable and you find a genomic region where it explains a lot of that phenotypic variance. And in this case, this is when you really need to look at the trait. So how is it currently phenotyped? If it's a trait you can evaluate right after seedling emergence, you just do it by observing, and just about anyone in the room could do it on their first try, it's probably not worth developing a DNA test and then genotyping with that test. On the other hand, if you have to wait 15 years to evaluate it, and then you got to use gas chromatography, and only Terrence can actually get the damn machine to work, it's definitely worth developing a DNA test. And then just a few examples to drive the point home. Back to apple fructose content. It's really hard to phenotype. It takes a lot of money to do it. And we found the genomic region that explains most of the heritability for the trait. But then, when you ask Kate Evans, so would you use this? She says, well, I don't really care about fructose content. My apples are already sweet enough, really. You know, and fructose is just a part of it. Then you ask Jim Luby, apple breeder in Minnesota, and he may have a completely different answer. So that's really when you need to start talking around to people. Peach versus nectarine. We know the genomic region, 100% explained. It's very breeding relevant. But then in peach, you can get fruit in about 2 years. It's pretty easy to phenotype, so might not be worth it, but it might be, depending on your breeding program and your breeding targets. And then apple EXP7 storability, that's just a specific locus for storability. The trait is really hard to phenotype because you got to store the fruit forever and you got to eat it, you know, all the time. Who wants to eat those really nasty apples after being stored for 14 months? It's a very breeding relevant trait, but this specific locus only explains 5% of the phenotypic variance. So alone it might not be, but if you can combine that with other regions, maybe it would be. So those are just my four basic considerations that I think you should think about before you go QTL hunting. And then I could pause a minute if there's a question here, or we could take them at the end. It's up to you if anybody has any. It's pretty basic. Okay, so DNA test development. Now you've got your QTL, what's next? So five basic steps in the process. And once again, recall consideration number one. Is it really breeding relevant? I took this image from a recent Rose Breed presentation slide where they found that there's about 2,300 QTLs that have been discovered in the rosaceae crop. So there's a lot of potential targets for the development of DNA tests. So before you jump in and just go with the one you're interested in, it's better to consider the traits, review the literature, and talk with breeders in the industry. And so the background color changed a little bit here, and I've just, to drive the points home, I've got some peach examples from my own work and that of Alejandro Salgado and Terrence Frett, who have helped me a lot in the process. And so in peach, there's a lot of really important traits. And then how many of you, the last peach you bought at the grocery store, you were satisfied with it? Okay, we got one person, right? And more than likely, it tasted like cardboard. And that's, they're picked too early and whatnot. But a big component of that is flavor. And flavor is resulting in a stagnation of peach consumption, and a big part of flavor is acidity, and just not enough acidity for the most part. But then when we look in the literature, we find, wait, there's already a DNA test for acidity in peach that could be used in breeding. And you have one genotype that it differentiates, the low acid versus high acid. So these two major groups. And you ask the breeder, well, why aren't you really using this too much? And they say, well, really what I want to know is, If it's really low, because it's not going to have much flavor at all, or if it's too high and it's going to melt your taste buds off, what we want is that right in the middle. And it doesn't explain that. So we talked to some of our colleagues and we found, hey, look, there's another genomic region that was found in University of California, Davis germplasm that explains 10% of acidity variants. We thought this might be a good target for DNA test development. And that led us to step two, which is validating the QTL in your breeding program germplasm, or germplasm that's relevant. And so your question is, do you really have a QTL that warrants investment in DNA test development? And to answer that question, you got to ask more questions. Well, how was it discovered? Was it in a biparental population that was developed in a foreign country on germplasm you have no access to? Or did you develop it in your own program? And then really trying to get at, is it detectable in your germplasm? And if you didn't find the QTL and it was developed on, and it was discovered on completely different germplasm than you're using, you're going to need to validate it in your germplasm. And this is going to require new representative germplasm that's been phenotyped, it's been genotyped, rerunning your QTL analysis, and hopefully finding the same results. Or if not, you've got a new QTL for your germplasm. And then in the peach example, this was found at UC Davis germplasm, which is a mix of all sorts of almonds and canning peaches, and it's something that's not relevant to most fresh market peach breeding programs. So we felt we needed to validate it. Our University of Arkansas peach breeding germplasm, good phenotypic data, new genotyping, reran the analysis, and QTL location and strength was validated. So we know this is a real thing, something worth targeting. And that led us to step three, which is, so you validated your QTL, it's time to really take a closer look at your QTL interval. And a good analogy for this would be if you look at your graphical output, and if it looks like the Himalayas, you're going to have probably good prediction accuracy with a nice high peak and not too broad. Whereas if it looks like the Appalachians, these long, flat, you're not going to have very good prediction accuracy, and you're likely going to need to do some new QTL mapping, increasing your marker density, and possibly even adding new germplasm that's segregating for your trait. So, peach example, there's about 5 million base pairs, which, depending on what map you looked at, was about 17 chromosome centimorgans. And so, fairly moderate size, but we had really good marker density with 17 genetic map markers and over 80 SNP markers in that region. And so we felt we were good enough to go to step four, which is where you look at your individual markers and you really confirm your marker, locus, trait association. So once again, going back to an MLT, which got to give credit to Fred Bliss, I think it was 2010 when he came up with that specific term, really important. And so this gets to really understanding the markers that underlie a DNA test. In our peach example, we're not going to want to run 80 SNP markers just to determine acidity in peach. That would be ridiculous, and you couldn't interpret those results. And so gets to what underlies a DNA test, and the first, and there's four marker types, called marker types. I'm not referring to single nucleotide polymorphisms or microsatellites, but more of the number of markers that underlie a DNA test. And so to do this, I've just got a little example here. There's your chromosome. Little yellow circle is the QTL you're really excited about. For a functional marker, and at least how I understand it, is you actually have to know your gene. And our gene here is Slimer from Ghostbusters. So we definitely know where he is. And what our functional marker is the arrow. And so it is what's in the gene that is actually responsible for that variation in the phenotype that you're witnessing. So whether it's a single nucleotide change that's resulting in a different amino acid, or it's an extra repeat in the promoter, or an insertion or a deletion, it could be any of those. Functional marker is going to be perfect, and it's going to be linked to your trait. It's going to be great, but it requires extensive candidate gene analysis. You're going to have to knock it out or transform it into tobacco. It makes really great publications, but might be more effort than it's worth to simply develop the DNA test that you want to use in a breeding program. The next step would be flanking markers. In this case, you don't necessarily know where the gene is that's underlying your QTL. But what you do know is that you've got a nice narrow QTL interval, you've done your good linkage mapping, and so there you've got your markers on either side, and each one is tightly linked to your whatever that causal agent is. And by having two markers, it allows you to pick up recombinant individuals. Whereas if you just have one, you won't be able to pick those up. And so theoretically, if there is a recombinant type, you can at least identify it. And then multiple markers, very similar to flanking markers, but in this case, it's just using more than a single marker. You don't really know if your markers are flanking your gene, but usually this is done with SNP markers because a SNP marker is biallelic, so at most you can explain three different genotypes. By using multiple markers, it gives you the opportunity to do haplotyping, where you are considering the combination of alleles at different SNP markers. And that allows you to pick up a bunch of alleles and pick up a bunch of genotypes. And for certain traits, having three genotypes just doesn't explain the whole picture as much as you'd like. Mm-hmm. And you can use this to pick up recombinant individuals too if you take a close enough look. And then finally, most of my work has focused is just developing DNA tests that it's just a single marker that's underlying it. Because they're relatively easy to develop, and as long as your marker is tightly linked to whatever is underlying your QTL, you may have, say, one centimorgan in between. You're still going to be 99% accurate when you're predicting and using this in breeding. And so most of the time, that's enough. Depends on the breeder. Some may want 100% all the time. But then others may say, well, I can have 10% can be recombinant individuals and it doesn't bother me. And in seedling selection, if you're screening thousands of seedlings, more than likely, having a few recombinant individuals that you don't pick up is going to be okay. But if you're really trying to understand your parent material, you may not be satisfied with having that big of an error in there. So all this is based on percent recombination. And like Michael said and Jill said earlier, you know, this is a lot of these things we're talking about today is subjective. So it's really up to you what Laws score you're going to use or what K value you're going to use. So this fits into that same umbrella there. And then continuing to step four, it's time to inventory your alleles, looking at the frequency in your germplasm and their distribution. And so this is blush example in peach across four different breeding programs. Very, very different genotype frequency across the breeding programs. And this is important because if you're at if you're at Texas A&M and you want to use this test in your germplasm, there's no point because you've completely fixed it in your germplasm. Whereas California, yep, you may have some use, and it really gives you an idea how to deploy it later on down the road. And then now it's time to calculate the actual effects of selecting or culling for specific alleles or allele combinations. And this can range from doing nothing, which I don't recommend, all the way to whole PhD dissertations that are based on really trying to understand the impact of selecting for a specific allele for a certain trait. But really what you're trying to get at, in simpleton terms, is whether or not the difference that you're predicting is functional. And so, does it have breeding utility? Or is the difference between one allele and the other one so minute that, you know, it wouldn't be worth really running at all? So that's what you're trying to get at there. And then this is a good time to start thinking about allele interaction and whether the system you're looking at is simply additive or whether there's a degree of dominance involved, because that will also be important later on down the road. And I'm going to go through this pretty quick just because I don't want to take into your lunch, but in our peach example, we had a whole bunch of SNPs, but as Jill pointed out earlier, a lot of times they're monomorphic, there was a bunch of missing data, a whole bunch of them were redundant. So when we took a closer look at the SNPs, we found that there were 9 that were associated with the city across years, across populations, and then the alleles and allele combinations were present in the germplasm we were evaluating. And this primarily done in Excel, there's a bunch of different software that you could use to do this. I just like Excel because it's what I'm used to. So just do simple analysis of variance, t-test, or linear regression of some kind, and you can figure out how much of that proportion variance each one is explaining. And by taking a look at the proportion of, you know, how much certain genotypes increase a trait above the average is a good way of looking at it. And then this afternoon, I can go into a lot more detail if anyone's interested on how we do this and share some Excel spreadsheets with you. That's definitely not an issue. So then we had our 9 SNPs, and we did haplotyping. And this can be done using a lot of the different QTL analysis software, but it can also be done manually in Excel if you just have some fancy formulas in there. And so we did our haplotyping. We found there were actually 12 haplotypes in the germplasm we studied, and there were almost 30 diplotypes or haplotype combinations. And this is one of the biggest challenges that I've run into, is actually then determining the effects of each of those haplotypes. Because some of them only had 3 individuals. So, maybe there was a recombination, so maybe it's just a recombined haplotype. Or maybe it's real, but, how confident can you be on predicting effects with just 3 individuals? I can't be very confident. And so that's one of the major challenges, but when we started to look at the haplotypes, we found that a group of them were routinely associated with an increase in acidity, and then the other group were routinely associated with a decrease in acidity. And we looked within our SNPs and we found that it only required 2 of the particular SNPs to actually differentiate those 2 functional groups. And you might say, well, Paul, that's pretty reductionist. But you always have to balance the data you generate and your ability to interpret and use that data. And so in this case, reduced down to the 2 SNPs, group it into 2 functional groups, high versus low, and we did some statistical analysis, and we found indeed there was a significant difference between the low homozygous individuals and the heterozygous and homozygous high. And talked to John Clark, and indeed that was seemed like a pretty significant difference in his germplasm, and both the high and the low were frequent in his germplasm. So at this point, theoretically, be ready to start testing this out and using it in the breeding program. But you may need to go to step 5, which would be marker conversion. So if you weren't happy with using SNPs and you wanted to use a simple sequence repeat marker or the opposite, you're going to need to convert between your markers, and this is really based on your genotyping platform. And if you're going to need to screen 100 individuals once a year, you can probably do it on a agarose or polyacrylamide gel and no one will go crazy. But if you're trying to do 4,000 seedlings, you cannot do it on a gel-based system. I mean, most of the time you've got a 2-week window between when you can extract DNA and when you need genotyping results, and you just can't physically do it. You'll drive your lab tech crazy. But I'm going to go through these next steps. I've got another slide presentation. I think there's about 80 that goes through all the detailed steps in this process. And so that, if you're interested in the afternoon, I'll gladly go over that with you. But I thought I'd just mention some of the online tools that I use that are free and available to the public. And although some of them haven't been put together for the rubus crops yet, soon they will. So this is the cutout from the genomic database for Rosaceae, which is maintained by the main lab at Washington State University. And this is the cutout from the GBrowse tool, which allows you to just go and surf whatever your genome of interest is, and this would be the peach genome here. We can go into our target region and then just click one button and download the sequence file. It's really, really easy and a fabulous tool. So you go in, you download your sequence file, and then you say, well, I want to know, in this case, where my microsatellite motifs are. Where are my repeats? So you can go, I like this Batch Primer 3 online program. It's also free, where you can just drop in your sequence, tell it you want to do some SSR screening, push the button, wait a few minutes, and then it'll identify all of those repeats for you. And there's probably dozens of softwares out there that'll do that for you. I just like this one because it's really simple and easy to use. So once you identify your repeats and you want to design primers flanking those, you can do that in Batch Primer 3. I prefer Primer 3 Plus just because it's got a really great user interface. It's got a good way to adjust general settings, whatever product size you want, melting temperature, advanced settings, all sorts of things, and ends up giving you some really good results that then you need to make sure are specific to the region you're targeting. And I think Jill mentioned this earlier, that the importance of, you've got a lot of repetitive regions out there, so the last thing you want to do is design a SSR marker that's going to amplify all over the genome. That's not going to be very good. So back to the genome database for Rosacea. There's a National Center for Biotechnology Information BLAST on here. You can go to their website too, but by going to this website, you can blast across just whatever genome you're interested in. And so I've got the peach genome in there, and I've got my primers, and they're ready to go, blasted, and it's specific to the region I'm targeting. So order your primers, and you're ready to go into the lab to where you need to test them on your germplasm. And then in my case, none of the SSRs picked up the differentiated the haplotype groups to my satisfaction, so I did a little multiplexing, and it ended up with a test that was able to differentiate my genotype groups very readily. Test it on your germ, on more germplasm, and you're ready to go. And a whole lot more details, but just see me in the afternoon, we can go over that. So, you got a DNA test now. It's time to deploy. So we get into the really exciting stuff, in my opinion. And so this is steps 6 through 11, and it goes back to consideration number 1 and step number 1. I'm sure you're all familiar with it now, which is, you know, make sure it works in your germplasm. Make sure it's breeding relevant and it's a trait that's of interest. So this gets the DNA test, what I like to call confirmation, and no religious confirmation here. I don't mean that analogy, but so essentially running a test on your germplasm before you make any keeping and culling decisions, because the last thing you want to do is use a test that doesn't work, because you can't go backwards at that point. Breeding specific program is required, and it makes a great opportunity for publications. So here's one where they tested a DNA test for seedlessness in table grape, and it's a really great publication, and indeed it worked, and I believe they're using this now routinely. And then this is also when you want to test for the specific allele effects in your germplasm, characterize the allele variability, and then answer the question, so what? Is it really worth using? Back to the peach flush example, I already went over this, so I'm not going to go into detail there, but very different allele frequencies in the peach germplasm that you need to consider. And then also, I haven't mentioned yet, but it's a really good idea to start thinking about other traits. Because if, for example, if selecting for the homozygous high blush resulted in having extensive bleeding from the pit, I don't know if it actually does, but if it did, likely selecting for that genotype for 10 years would result in some pretty bad drag that you definitely don't want in your cultivars. Step 7, time to characterize your germplasm and answer the question, are you satisfied? So do you have those alleles you're interested in, as Michael mentioned, in your germplasm? And if you are, proceed to step 8 and start doing some marker-assisted breeding. If not, go out and get some new germplasm. This is a really good opportunity to go to the germplasm repository and just screen everything with all the DNA tests you have and make a publication out of it. And make it available to everyone. That'd be really, really great. So, step 8, marker-assisted selection. So this is when it gets fun. And I have a really simple example here, just for those of you who may not have seen it in action. So we got two sweet cherries. They look about the same, kind of a light mahogany color. And skin color in sweet cherry is, it's a major gene. It's, you know, standard segregation pattern. So based on this, you could get all of your offspring being that kind of standard mahogany color. But at the same time, you could also produce that. And so if you were targeting that 25% of low blush, or the blush type individuals, you couldn't get it from that cross. And so it'd be a big waste of resources making the crosses, growing out the seedlings, seed planting them, waiting 3 years, and then evaluate them, and you don't have anything anyway. So this is where having a DNA test for cherry skin color would be very useful, because we could look into the genome and we could find, indeed, both parents had the genetic potential to produce a diversity of offspring, so you're going to get the 25% you want from this cross. And then you can look into the seedlings. Either you could extract DNA from the seed if you're feeling adventurous, or just go into the greenhouse when they just emerge and collect leaf tissue, genotype them, and only field plant that 25%. It's going to save you a lot of resources if you know that's what you're targeting. But before you go crazy with seedling selection, give it a test run, because there's a lot of the puzzle pieces that must be in place to get this running properly. And so requires an extensive investment, and you really need to consider how you would actually use the information. So how are you going to cull seedlings if you're going to screen them. And it sounds simple, but it definitely takes a lot of consideration, especially in programs where you're evaluating 40 traits. So are you going to eliminate 70% of your seedlings or 75% of your seedlings for skin color when you had 40 other traits that you needed to segregate in that material? Probably not. So different ways to do your keeping and culling. One way would be very stringent in a simplified example where across all your families you keep only the homozygous dominant, so you're looking at maybe keeping only 25% of your seedlings. On the other hand, you could just go pretty easy and only run the test in certain families and then only keep the homozygous recessive, so you're keeping the majority of those seedlings. Or don't cull and use the information some other way. If you had a DNA test for maturity date, for example, you could plant your field, orient your field based on the date it's going to ripen. And so rather than having to walk all 10 acres of black raspberries every week and looking for the one that's ripe, you could plant it in order that you know you only have to walk those first 10 rows this week. And the rest aren't going to be ripe yet, as long as you got a good DNA test for that. And then finally, some routine seedling screening. And to do that, you must have people like Alejandra and Terrence here in a lab, but they happen to have empty tubes and trays, but they're really reliable and they're dedicated. And so they need to be trustworthy. Last thing you want is them to mix up samples and that'd screw the whole process. It's got to be cost effective. And then, as I mentioned, sometimes your turnaround is only 2 weeks. And so this may require outsourcing to a service provider, or you can do it in-house. This depends on the resources that you have available. To do that, you're going to need efficient tissue collection and DNA extraction protocols. For a lot of these, especially the simple sequence repeat markers, you don't need that high quality DNA. You can do it with pretty crappy DNA. And so there's a lot of methods out there that don't require freezers, they don't require dehydrators, anything like that. You can just collect the samples in silica beads, put it on your counter, and 4 years from now extract that DNA and actually use it. So pretty cool. If anyone's interested, just find me later. I can show you details on that. And then, as I mentioned, efficient genotyping. You can't do it with gels. You're going to need to have a high throughput platform, so you may need to do some marker conversion. And then you're going to have a lot of data. Breeders already have a lot of data to manage, and so now they're going to have even more. So it's really important to be really on top of your data. And then you're going to have to interpret it. And so we use primarily Excel, but there's a lot of databases, Agribase, and things like that that are available to help you manage your data. And so you're going to have to go from raw genotyping data to producing your keep cull information, producing your plate maps, and then actually going into your greenhouse and knowing which cell matches with which tube. And I'm sure Julia could attest that this seems simple, but it's not. It's actually, when you have thousands of seedlings, it takes a lot of time and effort if you don't have it set up. So they actually went out and made new seedling trays to match the plate maps. That's how important they found this to be. And then step B. So this goes back to all the process, and I've explained this already, but the importance of making the information available. That's the whole reason I'm here today, is just to try to talk to you and give you some information and get everyone excited about these new technologies that are available. So write some DNA test release manuscripts. So find a QTL and don't just stop there. Go ahead and explain the markers that underlie that QTL, their effects, and their impact in different breeding germplasm. Go ahead and validate that QTL or confirm it works in germplasm and publish that. Most other breeders in the same crop would be interested to see that. And then deployment studies. If you have a breeding program and you actually run these tests, do some calculations, figure out how much you're saving or how much you're not saving and how accurate the predictions are, because others would like to see that information. And then finally, promise my last few slides so you can get to lunch, is just a little conclusion where, looking into my crystal ball, I see a few things coming, especially to the rubus crops. One is enhanced efficient genotyping. If you go and search for high throughput genotyping platform in Google every week, you pretty much see a new genotyping platform. It's incredible. And so that's definitely coming to your crop soon. Service providers. In a lot of the agronomic crops, there's already really reliable, established genotyping service providers that'll do a lot of this work for you, so you don't necessarily have to do it in-house. And that is starting to come into the fruit crops as well. With the demand rising, people are starting to supply that demand. Genomic selection, definitely not going to go into that here, but I think that will play a vital role in breeding in the future, but not as a single unit. It'll be combined with traditional breeding practices as well as standard marker-assisted breeding. Rapid generation cycling might not be that big of a deal in black raspberry, but in the tree fruit crops that take years and years to go from a cross to fruit, using genetic modification techniques or physiology techniques to just get fruit earlier is really going to be important. And then finally, those of us in here, not me, but several of you I've seen that are computer whizzes and bioinformatics, skilled in bioinformatics that are going to be available and coming onto the job market are going to be really important to have this marker-assisted breeding routine in breeding operations. Largest obstacles ahead, and this is true for just about everything you're researching, is getting funding for it. So if you're going to start culling and genotyping, that money's going to have to come from somewhere. Big data management is really important. I know that sounds cliche, but it's very, very true. Agreement and coordination. A lot of the projects, such as the Black Raspberry Project, the Rosebreed Project, are shining lights, I'd say, in people working together on the same common goal. But that you don't come across that very often. And I think that's really important to make some big licks. And then, as Ed said earlier today, phenotypic data. He generates a lot of phenotypic data for projects. And that is incredibly important. In my opinion, that's the biggest obstacle to overcome, is actually having good phenotypic data. Some specific recommendations for the rubus crops, for those of you working in rubus, is who in your breeding program is actually going to be dedicated to doing this? Because it's not something that you can just do offhand. It requires someone who is dedicated to the project. Who's going to be your DNA testing service provider? Are you going to do it in-house or are you going to outsource? You really need to consider that. Once again, the target of your DNA tests. Make sure those traits are relevant. Characterize your parents. A lot of times people get overexcited about seedling selection, and that's usually the first thing that's considered. But if you make the right parent choices and cross combinations, you don't even need to screen your seedlings for a lot of the traits. And it's just having a better understanding of the parents that I think is really, really important. And then give marker-assisted seedling selection a try before you actually jump off the deep end. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge Cameron Peace of Washington State University for all of his help over the years, Terrence Fred Alejandro and Alejandro Sagado at University of Arkansas, as well as John Clark, and the other breeders involved in all the work that I've mentioned, as well as all of you for listening to me. So with that, I'll gladly take any questions. I did it right on time. And as I said, a lot of this in the afternoon, find me. We can go over any of the details I just skimmed over, certainly. So
you emphasize the importance of testing potential QTLs within your population. And Jill had commented on the possibility of biparental mapping and association mapping. Mm-hmm. And your G7 slave was from an association mapping study. How often do you see a biparental identified QTL? Is that not being very significant once you go through a broader genetic background?
Okay. Yeah. So the question was, how often do you find a QTL in one population that doesn't necessarily work in other germplasm? In our case, for the peach test, we're actually using pedigree-based analysis, and so we have a whole diversity. And so a lot of times that does work across the germplasm. But I gave the apricot example for plum pox virus resistance. In the literature, I also came across a stringency in persimmon, where they had tested that. And then, I'm not sure, other people here may have some other examples. Terrence, have you seen any specific examples of that? Yep. So he was mentioning it really is trait dependent and...
and the DNA, like the one who's in the ancestor. and others don't have the disease at all unless that's what they are. So for those, I guess the CTLs is more of the alleles that are associated with high SSD are totally different.
Okay.
It's different. You have to validate across different classes.
Just to comment, and not to undercut any of this at all, because I think we're relatively at the front end of using this technology and fruit crops as opposed to agronomics. I was at a meeting in Bologna, Italy, focusing on molecular markers, and a woman stood up and said that her newest release, which is the fabulous apple, would have been discarded if she had used the markers that were currently being considered.
Yeah. And I have seen that myself too. So.
Right. It's not the answer to everything.
Yeah.
It's just supposed to support your reading decision, not take over and make the decision for you.
And along those same lines, sometimes you hear where breeders are worried about by doing the culling, they're gonna discard that magic that they would have seen otherwise. But you can think about it another way. If you have the resources to make more crosses and grow more seedlings, you could field plant the same number, but you know they're not going to have that critical trait that is going to completely eliminate the cultivar potential. So that's what really excites me. So. And what worries along those lines, a potential worry I see is culling so heavily that you're going to really reduce your genetic variance. And that could be an issue, but most of the breeders in the tree fruit that I'm aware of, they put extensive effort into going outside of the mean and really looking for new germplasm. And so the potential for genetic drift, for example, as long as they're going outside that and bringing in that new germplasm, I don't really see that as being that big of anything new. As far as concerned. Anybody else? It is lunchtime, so.
Yeah.